Welcome to the Full Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 8:10 British Summer Time. Today is May 27th, and of course, today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. First, let's have a review of what's been happening this week. And it's been rather eventful, particularly in the commodity markets, where the majority of commodities found at least short-term support this week, and a number of them in the region of their 200-day moving averages, or in the region of the upper side of previous ranges. So it's a natural area for them to begin to find support, and some of the leading commodities, such as the silver market, were particularly strong in the early part of the week and have lost a little bit of that momentum in the latter part of the week. And what it continues to look like is that we've entered a support building phase for commodities, and particularly those that have had the really large declines. And among those, of course, is silver, and oil is another one of those. The West Texas Intermediate price is currently at $100. It's up 30 cents on the day. It rallied well midweek, closing out the week in the region of this $100 area, and it continues to look like it's in a support building phase. That is a common characteristic to most of the commodity sector. Grains and beans are a little bit different because that's where you really have compelling fundamentals. Whereas elsewhere in the commodity sector, a large part of the move in the last few months has been driven by speculators. But in the grain and bean complex, you have really rather compelling fundamentals. You have floods in the USA, you've had floods in Australia, and it's been a pretty dismal 18 months for crops just about everywhere. And that's putting upward pressure on prices, and particularly that's of course on the supply side. And on the demand side, we have the major population centers of the world growing at an impressive rate, and the middle classes are expanding. So not only do we have greater demand for food, but a greater ability to pay for food, and that really puts us into a situation at the moment where you have supply inelasticity meets rising demand, particularly in food commodities. So that's where the really compelling fundamentals are in terms of the grain and bean complex. Now, stock markets have been pulling back for much of the last 3 or 4 weeks, and as we approach the close on Wall Street, the Dow Jones is up about a quarter of 1 point, the S&P is up about a third of a point, and the Nasdaq is up a tad more than that. The bounce that we've had so far, and this is, I think, the third or fourth day to the upside for each of these indices, hasn't been particularly convincing. And there hasn't been anything really in the way of large upward dynamics to indicate that demand is coming back in and to pressure any of the shorts in these markets. And they continue to look like they are in a comparatively steady but reversionary process back towards the 200-day moving average. In Europe, the DAX in particular has probably pulled back faster than most, and isn't that far away from the 200-day moving average, which is currently around 7,000, and the index finished today up a tad, and it was up at 71.63. In the Asian market today, the Australian market was a little bit steadier, and it's rallied for the latter half of this week, finding support at the lower side of its range. The Hang Seng was stronger by a almost or just less than 1%, and that's also finding support at the lower side of a range. And the Nikkei was a little bit weaker in here today, and it continues to look like it's going to need additional time to recover in here. And that's not particularly surprising given the blow the Japanese economy has had from the tsunami and the subsequent nuclear problems. The Treasury markets this week have displayed a large amount of commonality. And as we approach the end of the week, US Treasuries are closing out the week just down a very small amount on the day and close to 126. So that's been really quite an advance during the week. And There's been a high degree of commonality, so we've seen that Gilts and Bunns and the Canadian and the Australian tenures have all posted impressive gains this week, and government bond investors are beginning to price in slower growth, and demand across the sector is sort of indicative of that. We're also seeing that comparative safe haven currencies are doing rather well. The Swiss franc, in particular, has been very strong. It's right back down to, it was stronger today by well over a cent, and it come down to test the 85-cent level, and against the euro, it's close to 120. And that's the well, the Swiss National Bank aren't going to be particularly happy about that. Now, David has long said that happiness in the currency markets is having the trend and the central bank on your side. Well, the trend has certainly been on your side if you've been long of the Swiss franc, but the central bank is certainly not on your side. In the competitive world of globalization, there is nobody wants a strong currency. Some are prepared to tolerate a strong currency for a time. The Singapore dollar is a prime example of that, where the government uses the strength of the currency as a tightening measure rather than hiking interest rates. But in Switzerland, the Swiss franc has now got to a level where the central bank must really be thinking about intervention. And upward dynamics in favor of the Swiss franc, like we've seen today and at least once this week as well, at least one other time, that isn't going to go unnoticed at the SNB. So there is certainly potential for a reversionary move in the Swiss franc, the stronger that it becomes, particularly because it has been such an abrupt strengthening of the currency against the US dollar this week. And gold has also strengthened into the end of the week. It was below $1,500 for a time in the last couple of weeks, but it has bounced back emphatically. It's closing out the week at $1,534. It continues to look like it's in a support building phase. What we saw in the early part of this year before it broke upwards was that it was in this ranging phase, which where we had a number of failed upside breaks. And then it had a slightly larger pullback and then ra found support at the MA and then rallied really rather emphatically. We've had the big pullback, and gold's pullback hasn't been nearly as large as some of the other commodities. It's also been strengthening in other currencies, and not least because some of those currencies have become weaker against the US dollar in the last couple of weeks. But gold has been remonetized in the eyes of investors, and gold offers an investment case whether one is pessimistic about the prospects for growth in the US or in Europe, or whether one is pessimistic about the ability of fiat currencies to hold their purchasing power, or whether one is optimistic about global growth and about the allure of the yellow metal as a sign of increased wealth and ability for the nouveau riche to be able to display their newfound wealth. And of course, there is a simple bullish argument that demand is exceeding supply, and by an increasingly wide margin, because the production of gold has been stagnating for a number of years in an environment where the demand scenario has been going higher. And in that regard, gold crosses a number of different investment themes, because if one wants to take a pessimistic view of the ability of Europe and the UK and Japan and the USA to be able to grow their way out of their troubles, then one can make a bullish case for gold. The opposite side of that, of course, is that one can make a bearish case for government bond prices and a bullish case for yields. Something that we see at the top of absolutely every bull market is that supply explodes. In the Nasdaq, people were running out. In the Nasdaq bubble or the TMT bubble, people were rushing out to IPO business plans that had absolutely no chance of ever making any money. And in the commodity super cycle that peaked in 1980, people were rushing to open new mines to be able to participate in what were at the time historically high prices. But in a bond bull market, when supply explodes, you have companies and governments rushing out to lock in the lowest cost of capital that's been on offer for a generation. And that's exactly what we've seen. We've seen governments printing money like it was going out of fashion and buying up their respective bonds, taking on a huge amount of private debt. We've seen corporations rushing out to lock in the lowest cost of capital that they've seen in a very, very long time. Warren Buffett's Burlington Santa Fe has issued 100-year bonds in the last couple of years. Mexico has issued a 100-year bond. And that's a lot of supply that needs to be absorbed by the market. We've also seen that US government bond yields accelerated lower. They went from 4% to 2% in less than 3 months in 2008. Since then, we've seen a progression of higher reaction lows, higher major reaction lows on the US 10-year. The question now is just how long base formation development is going to take, rather than whether we're going to see additional lows. I think additional lows on the US 10-year yield look really quite unlikely. When we look at what's happening in commodities, we can see that a large number of commodities have broken out of inflation-adjusted downtrends. That's important because some of those downtrends were intact for more than 30 years, some of them for nearly 40 years. And the fact that those are now being broken suggests that inflation is out there on the horizon. It's already manifesting itself in higher growth economies. When one looks at the spreads between the 10-year and the 2-year, which is commonly referred to as the yield curve spread, there are three distinct categories of country. There are countries like the USA and the UK where the spread is remarkably high, and that's suggestive or indicative of lax monetary policy. It's unlikely to get any more lax, but it's still really at a quite an easy area. Then the next category of country, you have those like Canada, Switzerland, and the Eurozone, where monetary conditions are still reasonably accommodative, but they've turned the corner and they're now moving back towards some definition of normalcy. But then you have countries like India and China and Australia where the process of tightening is well underway. And to the extent that in China and India it has become something of a headwind for stock markets. Inflationary pressures are out there and rising in Asia, and commodity price inflation is non-trivial, and food price inflation, particularly in China and India, is a problem that the governments are having some trouble in getting control of. Wages are rising in China. They've gone up by 20% in June last year, 20% in December last year, and they're likely to go up again this year. So the flood of low-cost manufactured goods that have helped to depress prices for goods and quite a few services in Asia, in Europe and the USA has probably ended. And the deflationary pressures that China was exporting are likely to become inflationary pressures in the not-too-distant future. Now, inflationary pressures in Asia are probably manageable because they have such high growth rates, and higher interest rates there will help to bolster their currencies. We're going to have widening interest rate differentials in all likelihood, and there's an investment case for the Asian region in particular being something of a safe haven in an inflationary kind of environment. But stagflation is a much greater risk in Europe and the UK and in the USA. And that's a rather unpleasant scenario for equity markets in that kind of environment. What we've seen and what I've written about today is that the companies that are leveraged to global growth, those that are leveraged to the growth of the global middle class, have been outperforming and outperforming in spectacular fashion. These companies also cross a number of investment themes because they offer reliable yields in many cases. They have strong cash flows, and they offer the potential for capital appreciation because they are leveraged to some of the major bull markets that are developing out there. The global population is currently growing at about 1% a year. Global GDP growth is about 3%, and growth in places like China and India is in excess of 8% and often 9%. The countries that have done best and the countries that are likely to do best are those that propagate an ability for poor people to move up the ladder in terms of social progress. China's propaganda machine is publicizing or is encouraging people to believe that the harder they work, the better they will be able to pull themselves out of poverty and into the middle classes. And for hundreds of millions of people, that has already become a reality. And Wen Jiabao made a speech just before I went to Singapore, so about a month ago, saying that they wanted to eliminate poverty by 2020. And that means that putting in a more credible social security network. It means making healthcare more widely available, and it means rising wages. India is also propagating this Asian version of the American dream, that if you work hard, that you can make your life better. And the adoption of capitalism over in these countries over the last 20 and 30 years, in conjunction with flourishing global trade, has raised hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, and we're likely to see even more of those people move further up the chain in terms of standard of living in the next couple of decades. Those are progressing countries. We have regressing countries where standards of governance are not improving or getting worse, where social progression is a distant prospect, and that's certainly the case for a number of people in places in the Middle East where we've had the Arab Spring. And we are also, the progressing countries have less debt, and regressing countries tend to have rather a lot of it, both on a personal and on a government scale, and that's certainly the case for much of Europe and the USA right now. So we have this two-tier global economy where the progressing economies seem to be getting it all right in the medium term. And the debt crisis in Europe and the USA, particularly in Europe at present, but also in the USA, that what we've seen actually is that for most of last year, the euro was given a large degree of leeway because people were more worried about the state of the USA's balance sheet and quantitative easing too, and the fact that so many states are, for all intents and purposes, bankrupt. But now we've moved back to a position where nobody's particularly worried about that, and they're more worried about the Eurozone and the Greek debt and the potential for a Greek default or a restructuring of Greek debt and how that will affect Ireland or Portugal. and the exposure of not only the European banks but also the ECB to that type of situation. And these problems aren't going to be fixed overnight, neither in the Europe or in the USA, and that's going to take time to raise savings rates and to get these debt issues under control. The euro has fallen somewhat against the US dollar over the last couple of weeks. It was a bit steadier over the last few days. And that is where the majority of investors are focusing. However, when one compares currencies such as the US dollar or the euro to comparatively strong currencies, either in commodity-producing markets such as Australia or in high-growth markets such as the Singapore dollar, then it's not too difficult to anticipate where the strength is going to be. The Australian dollar used to trade at 140 during the last commodity bull market, and for a time it actually traded even higher than that. The Australian dollar has broken through the parity level. It hit a peak in the region of 110. It's currently around 16, and 106, and I think the lowest it's been in this reaction is around 105. So that's been a comparatively shallow reaction for a currency that is showing an incredible amount of relative strength, particularly against weak debt-laden currencies. I think as someone said, begging bowl currencies. And that isn't something that's likely to change overnight. We've had a short-term rally in the US dollar. It really would need to rally considerably more than it has done to suggest that a medium-term low has been put in. It was oversold in the very short term back in early May. It's unwound that oversold condition. If it's going to do more, it needs to do it. This is the time when it needs to put in an additional rally, and that at present is probably in the if one were to put odds on it, in around the 50-50 area. So the Swiss franc has certainly rallied, and the US dollar has rallied in the last few weeks, and stock markets have generally paused. Commodities remain a great opportunity, they remain a great risk, particularly the oil market, because oil at $100 is a headwind to global growth. The surge in government bond prices tells us that that investors are beginning to price in a slowdown in global growth. Stock markets generally have done spectacularly well in the last 3 years, and we're coming out of the first quarter, and some of the most recent earnings have been very encouraging, particularly for those companies that are leveraged to global growth. The next quarter could be a bit more difficult because high oil prices are a headwind for just about everything, and oil appears to be finding support in the region of this $100 in on the West Texas and over $110 for Brent crude. Commodity prices are likely to win out in a tug of war between stock markets and the inflationary pressures that come with commodity prices. Investors have been asking the question over the last few years about just how does one invest in commodities for the long term. And those commodity tracking funds that hold futures, specifically those that hold futures, are unlikely to be the best vehicle. If one wants to hold a passive position in commodities, then a number of people have just been going out and buying gold coins and silver coins, and that's certainly one way of doing it. And investing in a fund that holds the physical commodity, and those are available for the precious metals, is another way of doing it. But holding futures for the long term, it exposes one to contango costs, management costs, interest rate costs that need to be managed. And a passive fund doesn't do that. So those types of futures funds, don't tend to perform. If one wants to gain exposure to a particular commodity market where there isn't a physical a fund that holds physical commodities, then one really does need to start looking into some of the shares or into a managed futures position. Funds like the US Oil Fund or the US Natural Gas Fund have been an incredible disappointment for a lot of investors that didn't understand the risks that come with those futures funds. Every major bull market comes up with a new vehicle that allows investors to gain easy access to that market. ETFs are that vehicle this time around. It is reasonable to expect that there's going to be a problem with some of those ETFs by the time this bull market ends. This is a secular bull market. We've seen that these markets have been rallying for 10 years, and gold now appears to be entering the bandwagon stage of its advance. If at the very minimum, we are at the end of the beginning for this commodity bull market. The fact that we've seen so many of these commodities break out of inflation-adjusted downtrends suggests that investors are getting the message that the commodity bull market is accepted now among investors. And the question now is, how does one position oneself for the inflationary pressures that are a knock-on effect over the medium term for this advance? And the Dividend Aristocrats, those shares that offer leverage to global growth, or those that have a strong global franchise and offer a reliable yield, have as good a chance as there is to hold their value in an inflationary environment. And also those markets that have strong potential for capital appreciation, and in those the Asian markets, and those that are leveraged to the strong domestic growth in those markets, have also got a very good chance of doing that. And these are all fuller money themes. Technology is also a fuller money theme because it has the ability to introduce efficiencies that weren't previously available and create value. And I think with that, I will leave you for the evening and wish the a pleasant weekend to all of you.